You're listening to the cycling podcast of the 2024 Tour de France with Mitch Docker, Richard Hebron, and Graham Wilgos. Today we're in Rimini.
Got the message, say the bus is still in Florence, then we joked in the car, say yeah, for sure we'll win today now. That's just the way it goes, and yeah, when you have bad luck one time, then the good luck will come, so I think we can do without a bus today.
Welcome to the Cycling Podcast. The sound you heard playing us in there, the man you heard playing us in there, was possibly the happiest man in Italy today at the Tour de France. Matt Winston, DSM Director, Director Sportif. His man, Romain Bardet, has taken the first yellow jersey of this Tour de France, with a show-stealing, show-stopping turn that gave today's chaotic stage the finish it deserved. And with me, to begin the greatest show on earth and try and make sense of a chaotic stage, a chaotic day for us as well, boys, are Richard Abraham and Mitch Docker. Mitch, start us off. We'll get into the stage, we'll get into the race shortly. Where are we, first of all?
We're sitting really not too far from the beach here in Rimini, in Italy, a town I've never been to. This is an Italian stage today, and we've got lots to say about the Italian flavour of today's stage, don't we?
There's a big Italian flavour of today's stage for all of us. Richard, stressful day for you as well?
I don't know. Spent a lot of time just driving at 5k an hour, actually. It's pretty stress-free. We got kind of Italy, didn't we? A long old drive from the start to the finish, but we're here. And what a stage. What a stage, and what a finish.
What a finish. Well, let's get into it straight away with the tale of the etape. It was a cruel stage. In many ways, 37 degree heat, 206 kilometres from Florence to Rimini, with around 3,700 metres of climbing over seven punchy categorised climbs. Mitch, it was a breathless, hectic start. That started in the paddock.
Yeah.
Because the first 16K, you ran off in the direction of Luke Durbridge this evening to kind of get a flavour of how the riders...
Well, yeah, but before I get to Durbo to hear about their day, you know, somewhat uneventful compared to ours, but we'll talk about that. But let's talk about our day. Before we even got to the race start, it was sort of quite cool. Italy and cycling, it's got this sort of old-fashioned feel about it. And what I mean by that is, in my experience with the Tour de France, the last 3 years that is, everything has been super rigid, especially because we came off the back of COVID and everything like that. And we could barely get in and talk to riders as journalists. Today was free-for-all. I mean, the crowd was jumping barriers. I could barely get into the buses. There was riders weaving through. It was like old times in cycling. And as a journalist, I sort of hated it because I was trying to get interviews. But as a fan, I loved it. Because that's what cycling's all about, isn't it? Yeah. Being able to get close to the stars.
And the security guards, the poor old security guards in that big park in Florence. It was like those machines where the money's floating around, like with the wind, you know, whipping up. And they're just frantically trying to grab it and stop people. But, you know, eventually they're just like, oh, I'll give up, you know? It got a bit hectic, didn't it? It got busy at the start. Not entirely the best start for Jan Hurt, was it? A Quickstep rider, Sudal Quickstep, who hit... Did he hit a fan?
He was caught by a fan's bag, we understand it. Riding from the start back to the paddock, back to the bus. Caught on a fan's bag and went... Landed on his face, and so he's cracked his front two teeth in half, and he's cracked at least one more.
But he finished the stage.
Finished the stage manfully. Yeah.
And then our journey, I didn't see any roadworks, but what was going to be a long transfer anyway, 3 hours was four and a half. We got here with 20 minutes to go to the finish.
It was a race. We were racing the peloton.
As were the team buses. In fact, they only just made it through and probably helped. If they hadn't got their little badges that get them through the toll, you know, like speedy, then they would have been... hard pressed to get here.
Should we talk about the riders, I guess?
Probably should.
Man of the match today for Romain Bardet. Who are we saying? You were in on a conversation with him at the end, Rich.
As viewers of television screens across England may well have noticed, rather famously named Frank Vandenbroek, this was his first ever stage in the Tour de France. It's his first year as a professional for DSM. 23 years old. He's Dutch rather than Belgian. His sort of... eponymous namesake of the 90s. Do you want to know what his nickname is? I just did a quick little bit of research, and I was wondering how you say this in Dutch, because it's spelt exactly the same. So with the help of Google Translate, maybe this will come across. His name is... He's the Wattage Bazooka.
Love that.
The Wattage Bazooka.
That is the person you want with you when you're trying to hold off a peloton.
The Wattage Bazooka.
He lived up to his nickname.
He got in the break, and then he was there when Bardet bridged with what, 50-odd K?
50K to go. Off the front of the peloton.
This was the DSM strategy. Get in the break, get one of the climbers in there, and the one that stuck was the one with Vandenbroek. And then Bardet had that man to bridge across to, and the two of them rode like dynamite, didn't they, down to the finish. Headwind finish, the pack chasing, and a lot of big names still in there. Like, not only the GC riders that we knew were going to be there and thought were going to light it up, but also Mads Pedersen was there, Wout van Aert was there, got third on the stage. So, well, Wout's back. We know he's in good shape. And also, we know he was in tears, reportedly, at the finish line. I saw him zoom past me in the buses and obviously not happy.
I'll tell you a little bit about Wout. He was in tears at the end, as you say. He came in third on the day. So, Bardet first, Vandenbroek second, Wout third ahead of Pogacar in fourth. And Wout was very quickly in tears at the end, saying, "I never expected to be here at this level," obviously after his crash earlier in the season. It feels really good. He asked the boys to fully commit for the stage win. So as far as he was concerned, it was possible right up until the end there, but he was still over the moon to have finished the stage. And he obviously feels like, you know, he's got the same sensations that he's well used to, being able to do what he does. Quick question for you in here. Do we think the peloton, or the chasing pack behind Bardet and Vandenbroek, underestimated just how powerfully they were able to get to the finish?
Initially, yes, I would have thought that. But after sort of talking to a few riders and a few people around at the buses at the end, I think what happened was they just couldn't, because of the circumstances of the stage being super hot and the heat. The heat, it felt hot for me today, but of course I was sitting in a car with air conditioning most of the day, so of course I wasn't out there in the heat. And after speaking with Luke Durbridge at the end, he told me that already after the 16K neutral, he felt cooked before the stage even started. And then they kicked off, and then the stage, you know, went away. And I overheard an interview from Pidcock, and he said it was one of the strangest stages I've ever done, because legs were falling off.
So attritional, wasn't it? Yeah. There was no real like spice or aggression at the front. It was just folks were just kind of just like leaves, you know, just popping off the tree in autumn, like just one by one, like.
And that shows you how hot it was, how hard the terrain was. Yeah. But then it also highlights how good a ride that Bardet had. He just rode away like it was just a normal summer's day.
Yeah. Listening to what Pogacar had to say at the end of the stage, he thought the bunch were going to catch those two out there. And, I mean, a word on him as well. He out-sprinted a lot of, on paper, better sprinters than him at that finale there. You know, he got pipped by Wout van Aert, but otherwise he looks in good shape. From what we can tell today, you know, we didn't get the GC gaps that perhaps we were predicting yesterday, or everybody was thinking might happen. I think we can already read into that, like, Pogacar's on great form. You don't get that kind of result without good legs.
And the thing that made me think, why would he sprint in such a group with Wout van Aert there, with Mads Pedersen,
yeah,
you know, for the risk of just using extra energy? But that's him, isn't it? Yeah. He just loves racing. Was it about getting the time bonus, or was it just about, oh, well, I'm at the end of a race, I'm on to sprint?
This reminds me, I was chatting to a guy from Carnago yesterday in Florence and asking him about Pogacar, and Carnago's selling a lot of bikes, in short. You know, they're doing really well. And then what they were saying was, Pogacar's the kind of rider that doesn't make cycling look hard. You know, the kind of narrative often is that cycling is about suffering and grinding it out and, you know, enduring this really tough sport and, like, with a grimace on your face. Pogacar's just having fun. And that's, when you're trying to sell bikes, it's gold, you know. That's exactly how you kind of get people interested and keen in your sport. And yeah, I mean, we'll see what happens. I think we'll see a little bit more of Pogacar in the next few days.
We're going to bring part one to an end. We'll come on to the real meat of the stage in part two.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com. RiteRug.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.
Did you know you can save up to 70% on the best brands just by shopping at FromRebel.com? We're talking about strollers, car seats, high chairs, espresso machines, cookware, everything you need for way less. Here's how it works. Every single day, Rebel drops thousands of new products on the site for up to 70% off. It is a constant stream of endless deals from top brands like Upper Baby, Nuna, Baby Bjorn, Breville, Nespresso, KitchenAid, Le Creuset, and more. But you have to act fast because every deal is one of a kind. So if you see something you love, make sure you add to cart fast. So stop paying full price when you don't have to. Whether it's baby gear, kitchen upgrades, or a treasure for your home you didn't know you needed, Rebel has it for way less, up to 70% less. Shop from Rebel.com and save big.
We've got to get into Romain Bardet's day because it was his first win at the Tour in 7 years. It was DSM's first win in four. Rich, I mean, you were there with Matt. Tell us a little bit about what you heard before we hear from the man himself.
Yeah, I was sort of in the DSM scrum at the line. No bus. I mean, Mitch, what you were saying about the throwback, you know, it really was cycling throwback back to like 1980s, you know, Belgian showers at the back of a van kind of thing. It didn't even have a van, it was two cars. Yeah, Matt Winston was thrilled, obviously, and you could tell he was buzzing. The sports director had been kind of calling that. Bardet just, yeah, grinning from ear to ear, but was kind of apart from all the riders, like patting each other on the back, and you could tell he was just sort of absorbing it, letting it sink in. And he's been on the cusp of being that rider that the French so want in this race for such a long time. He's spoken about this before, but, you know, French riders who are contending for the general classification end up with this weird relationship with the Tour. There's so much pressure and so much expectation that it's almost like Stockholm syndrome. You know, they feel like trapped a little bit by this race, you know, kidnapped, but they kind of can't help but love it. And Bardet himself has ridden the Giro a lot recently, hasn't he? And this is his final Tour. He's just announced that he's going to retire next year, but he's going to go out after the Dauphiné. You know, he's not going to do the Tour. So it's a pretty beautiful win, I think, for that character. I mean, we were sort of maybe slightly dismissive of his chances before the stage.
Mitch, I certainly was. Yeah. I was reading a magazine and I saw they tipped Bardet for stage one. And I thought, who are they kidding here? Bardet? Because I really thought it was going to be, you know, a sort of a pick. I tipped Pidcock. I thought, you know, Pidcock, maybe even a Mohorič, you know, even like, you know, maybe even a Bettiol, just someone who could get over a climb, but they've got a bit of, you know, good descending skills, a bit of a sprint. But I just didn't think Bardet. I was like, but he knew it. 50K to go, even when I saw it, I was like, oh, a bit early.
Yeah.
But it was incredible. And the way it played out with, you know, with Frank as well, that combination together made it even that much better. To come to the line, I was hoping myself, I hope these two come to the line and they do a dual salute. And it just, that photo, could you imagine having that photo for the rest of your career? Both of them.
Yeah, that's what you got.
It's just going to be...
It's all down here, downhill from here, Frank. It's never going to get better than this in the Tour. Well, actually, you say that. I mean, Matt Winston at the finish was actually... He was basically saying that Frank Vandenbroek is going to have a target pinned on his back because he's basically told the Tour de France that he is... Well, he's the wattage bazooka. He's full of... He's going to be one to watch for the rest of this race, you know, in the breakaway or... Yeah. And someone else who I kind of got in the scrum with there in the finish was DSM rider Oscar Onley, and we'll hear a little bit from him now.
Incredible. Obviously, this is Romain's last Tour. Yeah, he wanted to put on a show, and I think he did that. And by the sounds of things, Frank was unbelievably strong. We all know how much of an engine he has. Maybe he doesn't get to show it all the time, but I'm sure today in those last 15K, he really showed the worth he has in this team. Yeah, me and Warren were just sitting behind, and we were really nervous for them, but in the last 3K we were confident that they were going to stay away.
What was the plan at the start of the day?
Try and get someone in the break, either going for the stage win or pick up points for the KOM jersey if it was a smaller break. And yeah, when it went, Frank was in there and it sounded like it was a really strong break. Obviously, we come in with a lot of expectations, but we're also realistic. We're not going to win the Tour de France, you know. But we came in wanting to race aggressively and go for stages and take opportunities where they are. And I think we did that today.
Chaps, I want to take us back to the start of the day and the break and the battle for the early break. which took a little while to get away for obvious reasons. You know, first stage, everyone riding hard on the front, big prize at the end of it. But with 170 or approximately 170 kilometres to go, six got away. Matej Moharic, Bahrain Victorious, Valentin Madouas, Groupama FDJ, Ion Itagiri for Cofidis, Clement Chapoussin for Arkea B&B Hotels, Frank Vandenbroek, the main man today, for DSM, and Sandy Dujardin. And about 166 Ks to go, things really started to settle down. So they were the ones who contested the day's intermediate sprint. It was Dujardin who took it. That aside, it was a long, hard chase for the peloton behind. Mitch, can you throw any light on from your conversations this evening around the team buses, how the pack was feeling?
Initially, you know, there was some control there, but I think everyone started to understand that it was a lot harder and it was a lot hotter than they anticipated. And that break was really hard to get back. You know, Luke Derby said to me that came to a point was like, let's just position Yatesy and just pull the ripcord. That's all they could do. Get our GC guys safe and get out, because they were just finding it tough. Yeah. And the break had that position. And we also saw the break implode as well. So it wasn't just the bunch feeling it. All riders out there were feeling it. And I think that was the narrative of today's stage. And I guess, are we sitting here and going, did ASO get it right? Did the Tour de France get it right again like last year? Starting with a stage like this, I think yes. I think gone are the days of the prologue to start. It's a bit of an anticlimax now. Okay, I'm not a rider, so I can say that now. I think the riders would wish of a prologue so they can just get into it. And today's a brutal stage. You do not want to start a Grand Tour like this. Durbo said to me at the end of the stage, I am completely empty. I am completely drained. And I've done one day.
That's Luke Durbridge, right? Off of Jayco. Durbo.
For our
listeners who aren't au fait with Australia.
I think they all know who I'm talking about.
We've got to do a little explainer of Aussie slang,
they know. Durbo, everyone knows who I'm talking about. Durbo, my good mate, Durbo.
It's a weird kind of heat here, isn't it, today? It's just still, like, heavy heat.
It's like, quite stifling.
Yeah. I've been on hot days where the sun is really beating down in the mountains, you know, and you can see the riders are sweating it out, but it's, like, the sky isn't really blue. It wasn't blue today. It was just this kind of grey, slightly dusty, polluted, like, blanket. Mm. And, I wouldn't have wanted to ride a bike today.
One thing we heard, sorry, just to interrupt here quickly, just to go back to Bardet and who picked it and who didn't pick it. We were listening today, and our friends Yenzi on the moto said, and I'm sure people who are watching the TV as well heard this, one in every 20 years, the breakaway goes to the line. And Adam Blythe replied to, Yenzi, are you mad? Have you lost your mind? Yeah. So Blythe was on my page. He didn't say exactly Bardet wouldn't win, but he said it's not going to be a breakaway. Yenzi picked it early. It wasn't a breakaway, but they went to the line. Essentially, it was a breakaway.
But it was a breakaway plus, wasn't it? Because the guys in that breakaway, you know, Madouas was dropping back. And who was the other one? Madouas was kind of went the furthest, didn't he, out of the non-DSM riders. But I don't think Vandenbroek would have had enough oomph to go alone and survive from the breakaway. It was only because Bardet bridged, and he bridged rapidly as well. You know, that gap was shut within, you know, it was like one minute he was jumping out the peloton, the next minute he was there going for it. And it was the fact that they had Bardet in there to kind of give it that boost with 50k to go that meant that it succeeded. So
one thing we haven't really spoken about is EF and the Bettiol story. And I had a chat with the boss, Jonathan Vorders, and I just said to him, because look, I couldn't get in there and I couldn't have a chat to Ben Healy, who I wanted to have a speak to. I said, look, JV, what happened today? And he said, look, I've only been watching the TV myself, but what I could see is Ben Healy, he missed the jump. And we could see that. He actually had the legs today to go with Bardet. He held that 1 minute gap halfway, but he missed the jump. He stayed there for 2-3 minutes and went. And my, on reflection, I think, Ben Healy, yes, he should have gone with Bardet when he went. But if he didn't go then, he should have dropped back and played the role. I'm not saying Bettiol could have won that sprint, but it seemed a bit of a weird move where he was just hovering in the middle there for, I don't know how many K it was, you know, 15, 20 K. But that was something that I was really interested to see. And I think they would have walked away from this stage going, we didn't really get what we wanted out of it.
Yeah, I mean, the most I saw of Visma Lisa bike today was the bus on the inside lane. But, you know, you guys were watching the stage while I was driving, but seemed like kind of job done as far as they were concerned as well. And Vingegaard, like, got him through, all good. Wout van Aert had a crack at the stage win, and, like, that's a big tick.
Vingegaard was off the back, actually, early on, very early on, and had to chase back on. And he dropped his bike computer as well, by the looks. And so he had to do it without numbers, too. So it sort of... It really fitted with the chaotic theme of the day, that you had the sort of two-time defending champion off the back. We're not sure of his form, we're not sure of his fitness, and riding without a bike computer.
There weren't any crashes today, were there? Or any big things like that? That's always kind of been
It's a shame, isn't it?
I love a good crash. No, it's a great thing, because that has often been the kind of...
Well, let's think about last year, the Bilbao stage. They started with a similar stage. There was lots of crashes.
But it's always been like a kind of motive for that. It's a bit of a puzzle, isn't it, on that first stage? How do you engineer a first stage in the race that kind of deals with that stress that you get in the peloton? I mean, one way of dealing with it is that you ramp it up to 38 degrees or whatever it was, and then that just kind of, no one really feels like getting too antsy or too nervous, you know? But actually, like, today there wasn't really anything to remark there, was there? A DNF for Astana? No kind of
casualties from the stage.
Casualties,
you're talking
about. Yeah.
We will come on to Astana and what we thought might be a huge story and a massive casualty for the stage. Just before we do, just because the break hoovered it all up, the King of the Mountains points on the whole went to Jonas Abrahamsen, Richard's Norwegian cousin. So he's top of the charts today with 13. Valentin Madouas is second on 11. Frank van den Broek, unsurprisingly, having spent most of the day out the front, or all of the day out the front, barring the last sort of couple of yards, he's in third. Yonex Itzagiri in fourth. Roman Bardet in fifth. And then the points classification has a slightly different feel. Frank van den Broek will be in the green jersey for tomorrow's stage. Roman Bardet second, Wout van Aert third, thanks to his third place finish today. Rich, DHSM, just one last word on them before we sort of put Bardet to bed today. Taking the yellow jersey home with them this evening, do we expect them to defend it tomorrow, or shall we come to that?
He's not going home. He's taking his yellow jersey to a Cubist hotel in Rimini. I think we can expect a little bit more spice tomorrow, can't we? It's not dead set that he's going to keep it. It's a small team, isn't it, relatively speaking? They've not got the big budgets of Visma Lisa Bike or Ineos Grenadiers or UAE, DSM. And you, like you said, they've been up against it a little bit, because they haven't had that big win for a while. Fabio Jakobsen is their sprinter here, but he's not really hit great form this year, and it's going to be really big for that team. And I don't know, I'm not sure Bardet would have finished his career thinking, oh, what if, you know, I never wore the yellow jersey. It's such a nice way of rounding it out, isn't it? And we were, you know, looking at the race parkour, we think that the GC favourites are going to really take over by stage four when we go into France and over the Galibier, right? So the chances for a rider who might not be up there in the GC to hold the yellow for a little bit is going to come in these next few days. And so this was kind of, today and tomorrow are the only two stages where somebody who isn't going to ride for the overall is going to get to wear that jersey. And so this was kind of Bardet's shot, wasn't it? He feels to me like one of the elder statesmen, and he's not. He's 33, 34?
33,
I think he's a child of 1990, isn't he? And those years where he was kind of one of France's best contenders that year, with, you know, when he got second, didn't he, one year, he got third another year, and it came quite close but never really quite had that kind of something about him that you knew was going to deliver him the Tour. And for him to kind of round off his time at this race with that yellow jersey, that just must be like, what a feeling tonight to be going to bed with that, you know, going to one of these sort of boxy hotel rooms that I can imagine they've all got in here and awaiting us later, and just with the yellow jersey. I mean, I can't imagine what that's like, but it's pretty special.
I think most of the peloton's on board what you're saying there too. Look, he's a well-liked guy in the peloton, and He's always been that. He's a likeable guy, I think, for the French public, but he's also a likeable guy in the bunch. So I think a lot of people were, you know, in a way, rooting for him to win today, and that it could come off and sort of do exactly what you said, round out his career in that way.
One more thing that Matt Winston, his sports director, said was that he and Roman were up until the early hours, straight after the Giro, that Roman was racing, talking about the Tour de France. And they were plotting what they were going to do. And then Bardet went off, did his training, and had this focus. Mm. And that's fascinating. That's, you know, Bardet was fighting for the GC for a while in the Giro, wasn't he? And immediately turned his attention to the Tour de France. And, you know, that's quite interesting to me. I mean,
I'm not surprised, though.
No?
Well, he's French. The Giro's a training race for him. But you know what it tells me? It's a good sign for the Giro Tour doubles. Pogacar, G. These guys are doing the double, and he's just shown, hey, it gives you good form. It's a great training race. Giro is a perfect training race for the Tour.
Don't let anyone Italian hear you say that, Mitch.
So, Mitch, talk to me about the day we saw Mark Cavendish have today, because he was off the back, struggling in the heat, with 158 kilometers to go, and almost immediately, as you would expect, he had a team around him: Michael Morkov, Case Bol, Michele Gazzoli, and Davide Ballerini also joined what became the chasing pack, who were hemorrhaging time.
It was a real surprise for me. Look, I didn't understand how hard that stage was from the outside until the end of the day, and speaking to all the riders, but I thought there was something wrong. I thought there was something drastically wrong. It's like, how could he be dropped already? And look, I'm putting my sports director's hat on now, because I'm one of those guys in the cars going, it's not that hard. I think it was just seriously hard. Seriously hard stage. So it really was alarm bells, I'm sure, for everyone watching. He's sick. He's not going to finish. He's throwing up out the side. It was interesting talking with Mark Renshaw after the stage to hear what he thought about that too. You know, he's like, you know, Cav's not sick, that's just what he does.
But in the car, you thought it was game over.
I thought it was game over. I was like, done. It's done, it's over. And we seesawed. It's done. Oh, he might get there. Oh no, it's done. And look, from an entertainment side of things, it was very, very entertaining. Is he going to make it? Is he not? What I'm wondering now is stage three still possible? That was my first question. Oh, yeah, you know, by the time he gets back, stage three's out the window. What I understand now is that all sprinters suffered today. It was hard for everyone. So stage three is not out of the window.
Possibly with the exception of Wout van Aert. So that might automatically make him favourite for stage three, just by dint of the fact that he possibly didn't suffer quite as much as anyone
Mads.
Else. But Mads was also strong today.
Mads was unbelievable. He got dropped and he got back.
Got back on. And in fact, finished seventh. So huge, hugely strong, as you'd expect. The race gets harder, Mads Pedersen gets better.
But it's always been the way, hasn't it, with the sprints in the Tour de France, is that kind of, well, certainly in the last 10 years, is that those kind of riders that can get over the lumps and bumps versus the pure sprinters. And it's like, when you come to a sprint, maybe there'll be a few climbs in there, maybe there won't, but you get the pure fast men, and then you get the guys like Pedersen. Pedersen's climbing really well. Great form all year, hasn't he? And Michael Matthews wasn't there, was he? But it was a strange experience to follow it, wasn't it? When quite often when we follow the race, you know, you go to the start and you speak to who you want to speak to, and then you get back to the car, and then you've kind of got this like lull, and you expect the race to just get going, unfold, the brake goes, and then the story kind of ramps up, and you get this crescendo, and then you get to the finish, and then it's like, right, This is the story of the stage. And suddenly we were found with like 100 miles to go, 150k to go. This could potentially be one of the big stories of the stage and of the race, because it looked like from all the indications was that Cavendish wasn't going to finish.
Hmm.
And then the next thing we saw was Michele Gazzoli DNFing.
So it's Cavendish's teammate.
Yeah.
He's not really a key part of the lead out, is he? He's not Case Bol.
To lose someone so quickly, to lose someone 100k's into the race. Do we think Astana got something badly wrong today?
Badly wrong? No, I don't think so. I think they played it well. Because I think if I look into it, They play their cards well. Cav got dropped because it was too hard. They sent their whole team back to ride him through it. And they got there in time. They kept it in time, the side limit. They controlled it. They didn't go over their limit. Cav's still in the race. They stayed together as a team. As a sprinter, you're feeling very confident in your riders because we stayed together. We stayed as a unit. We didn't just expose ourselves. Look at, you know, look at the difference of Jakobsen. He was out there on his own. I know on the other side, they had the winner of the stage, but you know what I mean? You know what I'm trying to say? They stayed as a unit.
Stayed as a unit, finished 39 minutes down plus change. Jakobsen, as you say, finished dead last. So I think I'm right in saying the time cut today was 48 minutes. So Cav effectively had 9 minutes still to play with.
Yeah, but I'm not sure. It didn't feel like a calculated, let's get in the Gruppetto and take it easy and use the time available to us. It looked like panic stations.
I think it looked like that, and I think we and the commentators built that up more than it was.
Yeah.
But knowing Michael Morkov, he's so calculated. And he would have been calculating that whole thing. Mark as well would have been doing that. And yeah, him throwing up and everyone playing up to it and not knowing it, in hindsight now, I think those guys knew what they were doing. Not I think, they knew what they were doing. They exactly knew what they were doing. They were riding in. They still had 10 minutes up their sleeve. It wasn't panic stations. I think early in the stage, they're probably thinking this is going to be tough. But they knew what they were doing. They knew how they had to ride. So only now in hindsight I know that, because I was definitely on the, is he going to make it, is he not? And now I look at it and I think, hang on a second here. You have got the best in the world at making time cut. These guys knew what they were doing.
Like, they're like darts players, aren't they? You know how darts players can like immediately get the, right, I've just hit dot, 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 these
Morkov
darts. What is my total
Morkov's
there?
Morkov's insane at that. I've been out the back with him in Tour of Suisse. I was out the back with him, Viviani, and another lead out man. We rode the whole way out the back. He's like, calm down. I'm freaking out. Calm down, calm down. He just knows how to get through.
So is the kind of time cut and the pace, is that like vocalized? Would Mark have just known, I've just got to follow Michael because he knows? He knows the time cut. Or is Michael saying, come on, Mark, we need to ride a bit harder here?
Yeah.
Or, you know, we need to make up 5 minutes on this descent, or, you know, how does
that... Yeah, well, I think Mark also would know his limits too.
Yeah.
And they would have been speaking with each other. What's the time gap? How much do we need to push? Where can we make up time? We need to be at this time at the top of that climb in order to have a chance. All that conversation would have been happening. Where do we sit? Constantly talking to Mark Renshaw, a guy who's also played a lot with fire when it comes to time cuts. So, look, I'm only realising this now, but I think these guys were a hell of a lot more calculated than we thought.
And what does your mate Mark Renshaw make of it all this evening?
Mark Renshaw? Mate, what happened out there?
It was a one-day race for us, probably for a lot of guys, and the heat really caught a lot of guys off guard. The first 100Ks of racing, super, super difficult. A lot of guys on their hands and knees out there, but, you know, Cav came, I haven't spoke to him, I'll speak to him now, but he came really good in the second half.
What happened, from what you understand, with him? You know, we saw him throwing up from the bike. It's a big change from yesterday. We're at the press conference. He was looking well. Is it an overnight sickness? Do you have any idea? Is it heat?
No, that's a standard Cav thing, to have a vomit on the bike. Yeah, what's more, I'm not shocked to see Cav spewing on the bike like that when they're trying to get in so much fluid and the temperature today. But losing Gasoli is a big problem. So we didn't need that. And yeah, he also was suffering, vomiting there at one point, so I'll jump on the bus and see what the go is.
Gents, one more bit of business to round off from today's stage. We mentioned him at the beginning, Jan Hurt. He finished just over half an hour down, but riding, as we said, with two broken front teeth, he's got to have some pretty major dental work done. Finishing today's stage at all was impressive. But
speaking as somebody who's... I didn't really ride into a pedestrian, but I rode into a car and sustained some significant front teeth damage. I wouldn't want to ride my bike tomorrow. I'd want to go to the dentist and get it looked at and make sure we'll see whether he starts. He's a pretty key rider for Remco Evenepoel, isn't he, Jan Hurt? Kind of all-rounder, domestique. Nobody wants to lose a rider this early on in the race, do they? But it's not great news for Soudal Quickstep if he can't start tomorrow.
And he rode the Giro and he looked very impressive. He was he was up there going for stages. Yeah. Okay, he didn't get one, but he still, like, he showed just how good he is, just how good his form is. We wish him well, and he's going to be important to Remco's challenge, and hopefully he's in better shape tomorrow.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com. RITERUG.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.
Rich, one more story that sort of feels like old news now, just because so much has happened today, is the fact that Steve Cummings, the Ineos DS, is not here, and Tom Pidcock very much is, but it was as a result of their falling out, which we got a little flavour from, Netflix's Unchained series. It's a sticky situation to get into on the eve of the Grand Tour.
So the story is that Steve Cummings, the kind of lead, who is going to be the lead director sportif here at the Tour de France for Ineos Grenadiers, is not here, and he's been replaced at the sort of not quite last minute, but quite last minute, by Zach Dempster. The story's kind of been unfolding over the last few days, really, and there's been a lot of chatter around it. It doesn't look great for Ineos. I was able to speak to John Allott, who's kind of the new boss at Ineos Grenadiers, and, well, it was kind of 3-minute variations on no comment. You know, he didn't want to be drawn into it at all.
It was a politician's interview.
It was a politician's interview, yeah. We put it to him because we've heard rumours about perhaps the various reasons why Steve Cummings might not be here. And one of those reasons is that Tom Pidcock might have had an influence in the team. And the response to that was no comment. He wasn't going to be drawn at all. It's one of those stories that's probably going to subside and wash away as the tour goes on. But it's not great, like, inverted commas, optics. I don't really like using that word. But if you think in a kind of business or a profile sense, it doesn't look great on the eve of the tour to have that kind of a story lingering. And I suspect it will go away. I spoke to Zach at the start, and I think Zach was one of those riders who, actually, when I started out reporting on the kind of British scene, Zach was racing for Enduro Racing in the UK. So he was doing these, like, local races, and, you know, it's a big step up for him. He's not been a DS for long, has he? And I mean, Mitch, he's kind of your, like, generation. He's like the same class as you, right, from Australia. And here he is DSing the Tour de France. He's just done the Giro, got Geraint Thomas to third overall there. And
well, he did the Tour last year with Israel Premier Tech. So he's been at that level. He's been under that pressure as well. He's also director sportif of the Australian national team at the Worlds. So he's done some big stuff. I don't think he's nervous of stepping into this level. And maybe there's some extra pressure with the team. They've looked at what he does. And, yeah, they like what he does. He's very meticulous in what he does. Yet, he's been a rider. So, you know, it's that nice combination. It's cool. It's really cool to see, you know, a personal friend of mine, Demers and I, Bendigo Madison winners, Zach Dempster and I. Let's go back there and relive that. Demers, when we're doing the Madison together, mate, we need to get back there. But yeah, it's cool to see, but I think there's more to that story that I want to know. Because look, Steve-O, I really like Steve as well, and I thought he'd be a great director, or is a great director, he's a great guy, and I feel like he has a really great understanding of the peloton, how to win. Think about those wins that he's done in the Tour de France, they're amazing.
He's a real tactician,
yeah,
isn't he? He would pinpoint stages, you know, months in advance, and he knew exactly how many watts he had to ride on the final climb to win that stage and stay away from the chasing pack, you know. So that stage in, like, Monde and the Monte Jalabert, right, where he kind of outfoxed Bardet, I think, and Pinot, right? And then he was in the breakaway one stage on the Aspen, I remember, and I can't remember whether he stayed away that day or not. He might not have done for Quebec. Anyway,
the point is, yeah,
he's a great man to have around.
But something's not right there, so we don't know yet, but...
I asked you this this morning on Run Club, the cycling podcast Run Club. Is it a case, do we get the feeling that it's kind of like you'd hear in football, soccer, Mitch, all the time, is the player bigger than the team? And if the player is bigger than the team, do you have a more serious problem on your hands?
Yeah, that totally. Yeah. I think you do.
I think It would be really interesting to see what happens with Ineos at this year's tour and what they get out of it, but also kind of what direction they go in after that. And we never really did a deep dive on the Netflix documentary, did we? But one of the things that stood out to me there was the influence of Dave Brailsford. Where, you know, he comes on the tour and they win two stages. It was the Rodriguez stage, wasn't it, over the Juplan down into Morzine, and then Kwiatkowski won the next stage, I think, on Grand Colombier, right? You know, you get these teams, and it happens in all sorts of sports and probably in all sorts of walks of life, where Dave Brailsford was the cog in that. It was the central point, wasn't he? The whole team was kind of not built around him, but he had such an influence over everything. And I'm not sure they've been able to replace him, and maybe they never will, but it's kind of a like, well, what? How do we do it? How do we do it next? And I'm not sure they've really answered that question. It's maybe been borne out in the results. They haven't had a Tour de France win since 2019. They're going by now. Yeah, let's wait and see. They've got a good lineup, haven't they? We'll wait and see this year.
L'étape de demain, le dîner d'hier. Tomorrow's stage, yesterday's dinner.
Pretty good, eventually.
The longest meal I've ever had, and Mitch was falling asleep at the table.
Poor old Mitch was still on. What time zone were you on?
It was
like
11:30 at night. You're making me sound like I fell asleep at 3 in the afternoon. It was 11:30 at night. I was about 4 bottles of wine deep. You know, like, Jesus. I'm not Terminator. Eventually, I do tire out.
Richard was talking
you are
about
in good,
me.
You are good shape, though, right? We didn't mention this.
No, yeah, oh my gosh. Mitch, how have we not mentioned this already?
Highlight of Mitch's tour happened the day before we even begun.
How have you not mentioned this already? Because it's all you talked about yesterday.
So we went into the bike show next to the press centre it was at that point, and we're walking around there, and there was like a Rule Air had their show on and things like that, and I was just sort of hanging around checking it out. We're just sort of killing time, and in a conversation I just caught the corner of my eye and I was like, is that Jan Ulrich? And then I had to do a double take, and the conversation I was in, I just literally deadpan walked away mid sentence. I was like, that's Jan Ulrich.
You left me.
Yeah,
I mean, luckily I knew the guy that we were talking to, so I was fine with that. But Mitch was just like,
I'm out.
I'm off. Like just a magnet being drawn away, you know?
It's the first time I've ever met Jan Ulrich, and it was seriously a cool moment. He is one of the guys that got me into cycling, watching those tours, you know, those early 2000 tours. 2003 specifically, I love that tour. And I got a chance to meet him, shook his hand, and he said to me as we were shaking hands, we did like a monkey grip sort of like bro pal handshake.
If I may, it was almost like Rocky IV, where you've got the
it was
the
total
Stallone
Rocky IV,
fist
wasn't
meets
it?
The Ivan Drago, the Russia meets the US.
And if you could ever get something whispered in your ear from your idol, it'd be, oh, you're strong. You've got shape.
You've got shape. That was the exact
You've got
words.
Shape, as in like, you've shape. Got good form.
But that carried you through. But like you say, you're not the Terminator. Me and Rich talked about this because you were on excellent form the second you got off the plane, having had a horrendously long flight from Melbourne. You've been on superb form up until about 20 past 11 last night, where it was almost like a cartoon. If you wanted to, you know, you wanted to draw a cartoon and to explain just the effect jet lag has. It's like you were on 1% battery.
The heart said yes, but the body clock said no.
It's like, I want the grappa.
Yeah. One of our fellow journalists who lives in Italy was explaining this. Apparently, during COVID times, they chucked a load of, you know, they had to have tables outside, you know, for ventilation and reasons. And so they got kind of beneficial ground rent, you know, on outside tables. The net result of that is that a lot of restaurants have basically upped their, you know, headcount, their covers, by way more than their kitchen can manage. So when a table of 20 journalists, as this was the kind of pre-Tour de France, like Anglophone press pack kind of get together. And yeah, we were there a while, weren't we? But it was good food. And it was hot. I had sandals on and took my sandals off and felt the ground. You know, Florence is a city of like these huge stones, and they're quite kind of, they're not light stones, they're big, dark, heavy stones. And
well, they
and
just absorb just the heat, hot, don't they?
It's like a radiator. It's like standing on a radiator. And we were sat in that for a while, just sweating it out. But a good time.
I'm just going to preempt a quick corrections corner, because Ivan Drago was, of course, Soviet Union in Rocky IV and not Russia. My mistake. Let's get on to tomorrow's stage, boys, shall we? Cesenatico to Bologna. So we're just up the road to start. And we are 199.2Ks tomorrow, so just short of 200Ks. Slightly kinder, but still with 1,850 vertical meters, six categorized climbs. The last two of those will be they're looping around it twice, the Basilica San Luca in Bologna. Mitch, you've got some intel. I don't know if that intel will have changed after today's stage. Tell us.
Well, I did speak to him. He's a bit of my favourite lately, Stevie Williams. Let's hear what he had to say, because I threw him a bit of a curveball. I didn't ask about today's stage. I asked about tomorrow. Stevie, today or tomorrow? What are you thinking, mate?
I don't know. Tomorrow's probably better on paper. The long climbs today. I mean, they're not super long, but you know when they're just like long enough, you know, where, you know, for the pure climbers, you roll over it, but it just takes a bit more out of me. I think tomorrow's a better day. Today's going to be, I still have a chance, you know, but yeah, tomorrow's the main day, and hopefully we can be there today and tell myself I have good legs and get over there and then try and sprint from a small group. Ideally, that would be ideal. If I can just get over group of 20 and just kick it out. And then tomorrow, at least then I'll know I'll have good legs and can, on the shorter, steeper stuff, I'll be able to hopefully be there.
So what do we think of his chances?
I'm questioning his chances now because he was dropped early. And I'm saying that he should have been there fighting for the finish. I thought he might have been, but if he was waiting for tomorrow, he didn't get dropped in a strategic group. He was sort of just dropped in a small group. I'm wondering, he's a rider of extremes, he says. Either it's too hot, Tour Down Under, or it's too cold, Flesh Will On. And I thought today was going to be good for him because it was an extreme day. But I don't know. I had Stevie Williams down for tomorrow too, but this really makes me feel uneasy.
Rich, what do you make of tomorrow, and particularly that climb to St. Luca?
Yeah, it's kind of, well, we're Alaphilippe here. It's an Alaphilippe stage, isn't it? I think there's maybe similarities slightly with that finale that we saw at the start of the Giro, right? A sort of short, sharp climb. Nothing to worry about if you're a sprinter, but it's the sort of terrain that's going to tease out those Ardennes Classics riders like Stevie Williams and also the GC riders. Well, again, you know, listening to what Tadej Pogacar had to say about things, he reckons there's going to be a lot more action in the GC battle tomorrow than there was today. It's kind of got that feeling of, like, maybe set a trap, maybe get a rider up the road. You know, there's two laps of that Basilica circuit, aren't there? So, do we know how kind of... I'm imagining, you know, quite claustrophobic, steep, narrow road, right? It's sort of classic Italian hilltop. In fact, I think we passed it, didn't we? We saw it from the motorway, the Basilica.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, like a mountain just kind of sticking out of the plain. And that's what the stage is, isn't it? They shoot along the plain alongside the motorway and then just divert up the climb, back down along a bit more, and up again. And
it's pretty brutal. It's 2K almost at 11%.
Yeah, so.
So, you know, that's go and ride a 2K climb at 11%. You know about it.
Very good, Mitch. It's 1.9Ks at 10.2%. Excellent. Who are you going for tomorrow? Are you sticking with Stevie?
Oh, I don't know. I haven't done my prediction for the stage yet.
I like Vanderpool for tomorrow.
Yeah.
I quite like Remco. Finished top 10 today. It's sort of short enough, punchy enough that it really suits him.
Yeah.
And you can get away at the end.
Yeah. I mean, a word on Remco. I was chatting to a Belgian reporter this morning. Remco, I think this has been remarked upon a little bit on social media, but it's always kind of slightly dangerous to get the kind of social media judgment, but Remco looks in a lot better shape than he did in the Dauphiné, and he seems a lot leaner and a lot more kind of, yeah, he's really thinned out, and apparently this is Patrick Lefebvre, you know, I kind of have this third hand, but Patrick has commented that Remco is one of those riders who you can kind of tell his shape based on how thin his face looks. And he's looking in good, yeah, from looks only. Again, you know, the disclaimer there.
It was difficult to tell this morning when he walked out of the bus because he's one of the few riders, in fact, he might be the only rider to be wearing a face mask.
Yeah, COVID. I wonder whether we haven't seen the last of that in this race, but let's see.
It's like this luring sort of, you know.
Yeah.
Lurking, rather.
Let's hope. Yeah. Fingers crossed. But, I mean, we should mention where we are and where we will be tomorrow morning and the kind of significance of that in the grand scheme of things, right? That we're in Rimini, and we're about, I'm going to say we are a few hundred meters from the hotel where Marco Pantani
spent his last hours
and was found in his hotel room in 2004. And tomorrow morning we drive over to Cesenatico, his hometown. That will be big on the Pantani, won't it? That will be the Pantani morning. But it was funny because on the walk back from the finish today, just to our hotel, which was only a few hundred meters, we went past the hotel. It's I've got the name of it here, La Rose Suite, or the Rose Suite, you know. And there's nothing. There's no memorial or tribute to Pantani there. It's just a hotel. It's had a refurb in the last 20 years, but it's kind of funny. It's part of the myth, isn't it? And it's part of the celebration. Well, not the celebration, but it's part of the Pantani story. But there's been no mention of it. Mm. I haven't heard anybody else talk about it. There was nobody hanging around the hotel, or, you know, I think it looked like a few press might be in there tonight. What I was struck by, this is a kind of industrial tourist town, isn't it? It's, I mean, Graham, you and I saw some of the wine bottles, and it's probably not good for the algorithm to describe what was on those wine bottles, but yeah.
It was bad.
It was very tasty. Imagine the most tasteless thing you can get, and it's pretty close to that. Pantani died here on Valentine's Day, didn't he? February the 14th. So imagine this place out of season, and it's cold and it's grey, and the sea is cold and flat.
Yeah.
And
It'd be very sad, wouldn't it?
Melancholy to that. I felt a bit awkward. I didn't want to feel like a kind of dark tourist, you know, going and kind of rubbernecking on the place where this man spent his last hours. But I was curious to see what it was like from a kind of tribute perspective. And it really left me feeling slightly melancholy, just slightly. And I didn't want to hang around. I got on and
maybe it's right, given his life came to such a sudden and desperately sad end, that he is celebrated on the climbs that made him, or that he made himself famous on. And his name is still scrawled across climbs from Alpe d'Huez to the Mortirolo,
yeah,
which we were talking about yesterday, Mitch.
There's everywhere you go in Italy, there's a Pantani climb. You know, it's like places want to kind of grab a little bit of this myth, you know. It's like, oh, this was where Pantani did that thing in that race, or oh, this was one of his key climbs. You know, there's quite a lot of them. You know, that we had a Roper, didn't we, on stage two in the Giro. There's the Pantani memorial that will go past, or well, the riders will go past on stage four on the Galibier, right? And well, we'll see what tomorrow brings in his birthplace. But there's a kind of Pantani museum, which I think I quite like to go and check out, you know. And there's a bit of memorabilia and stuff, so.
I guess the difference here is they're happy moments,
exactly,
you know, opposed to this moment. It doesn't need to be celebrated.
No.
They're celebration moments, you know, and I think tomorrow will be a celebration because of it's a positive moment, you know, it's, yeah, a happy moment.
You still see the old boys out on their old Bianchis with those Mercatone Uno shorts that have had a few too many washes, you know, and a little bit stretched and a little bit, you know, they're not covering up as much as they used to, let's put it that way.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's, I mean, we don't need to go into much more depth than that, but he's still got that place in the kind of psyche, hasn't he, here in Italian cycling. And it feels right that maybe we get an opportunity tomorrow to kind of recognise that.
And we'll look out for those Mercatone Uno shorts as well on the road.
Bandanas.
Mitch, Rich, we'll say ciao for now.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Burney.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com. RiteRug.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring. Right.